Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for January 11th, 2018. On today's show, we're going to be diving into a bunch of news, including the changing copyright laws, 2018's DGA Award nominations, a Black Widow and Gambit movie, and Fox is shifting a lot of their superhero release dates. And in the spoiler room, we'll be talking a bit more about Star Wars Last Jedi, including new secrets revealed, the original ending of Star Wars The Force Awakens, and Rian Johnson's explanation of the questionable moment in the ending of that film. This is Peter Serretta, and joining me on today's podcast is Slash Film senior writer Ben Pearson.
Hey, what's going on?
And Slash Film weekend editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
Okay, guys, why don't you join me over here by the water cooler? We have a lot on today's docket, so hopefully we can get through all of it in under 40 minutes. That is the goal.
This water is really good, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's from the Slash Film water cooler, so it has to be refreshing and good. Okay, so Brad, what have you been up to? Have you been watching movies?
I have, yeah. I keep catching up on some stuff that I missed last year. I just got around to watching Darren Aronofsky's Mother, or Mother. And I really enjoyed it, actually. It's very odd, don't get me wrong, but I kind of understood what he was doing and what was happening in the movie. So, yeah, I find myself really liking it. It's not a movie that I can see myself revisiting very often, but I was glad that I got around to watching it. And I also watched Last Flag Flying, which is kind of an understated war drama from Richard Linklater. It stars Steve Carell and Lawrence Fishburne and Bryan Cranston as these three Vietnam vets who go on this road trip after Steve Carell's son, who also enlisted in the Marine Corps, dies in Iraq in 2003. And I was... I'm kind of surprised that this movie is not getting more awards buzz. It's this very mature war drama with fantastic performances, very character driven, and I really enjoyed it. Bryan Cranston was especially fantastic in this movie, but all three of these guys are fantastic in it. And I wish it was getting a little bit more awards buzz because I think it deserves it.
Interesting. I'll have to check it out. Richard Linklater is one of those filmmakers. It's either, you know, love it or leave it for me. And I thought this film was going to be one of those films that I wasn't going to have to check out from him. But it sounds like you liked it. So I'm going to have to check it out. Ben, what have you been up to?
I've been catching up with Saga, which is a comic from Brian K. Vaughan that is years old at this point. I think the original issues first came out in like 2011 or 2012 or something, but I'm finally getting around to it. I know, Peter, you're a fan. Jacob Hall, who is the managing editor of Slash Film, is a big fan as well. And just hearing you guys talk about it over the past few months, sort of as like news stories have popped up here and there about maybe a potential movie happening or in more cases not happening, has really sort of piqued my interest. So I finally got my hands on the first volume, like volume one, the collection, the trade paperback collection of the first few issues. And this is a really, really fascinating sci-fi story. It's like a bizarre sort of Romeo and Juliet meets Star Wars meets Lord of the Rings kind of thing. It's really tough to describe because the world is so unique and interesting. The official description says, when two soldiers from opposite sides of a never-ending galactic war fall in love, they risk everything to bring a fragile new life into a dangerous old universe. Saga is the sweeping tale of one young family fighting to find their place in the world's fantasy and science fiction are wed like never before in this sexy, subversive drama for adults. And yeah, I mean, there's like some graphic sex stuff in this that I was not really expecting, but it definitely feels like a mature comic that is in line with the stuff that Brian K. Vaughan has done before. I'm a big fan of Why the Last Man, which is a comic that he was responsible for. And this sort of, I mean, it feels totally different, but you can tell that the voice behind it is the same. It's somebody who's interested in grappling with sort of fascinating new takes on, I guess, familiar tropes. And I can't really say much more about it without spoiling anything. And I would encourage people to dive in. I like I said, I've just read volume one, but I ordered on Amazon the next three or four volumes. So I'm excited to dig into those whenever I get a second.
You're all in. I love Saga. I love how different it is. I love how, you know, I'd love to see the world adapted into a TV show or a movie, but like it's almost like, I mean, I know Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples have both said that they kind of created this with the idea of it never of it not being possible to adapt it to another medium. Yeah. I still think it's possible, but I don't think it would be possible to capture everything that
and not for nothing George R. R. Martin created A Song of Ice and Fire specifically to not be adaptable, and that was obviously adapted into Game of Thrones, so it sometimes it's possible.
I'll talk about last night I presented an award at the first ever Los Angeles Online Film Critics Society Awards. This award society started this year. I was part of their inaugural members. It's a group of film critics in Los Angeles, as the name suggests, mostly writing online. It's a cool group because a lot of film critics only take people that write film criticism in text form of some kind. And some people won't even take people that write online. The cool thing about this is we have some members that, you know, do active reviews on YouTube and, you know, have a large audience in that capacity, or podcasts like me. You know, so it's not just text. And the society as a whole is very cool and very progressive. Half of the inaugural class is female. So we're, you know, they're trying to push the barriers of making it equal. And the first, we had our first awards last night, which I expected to be, well, first of all, when I got accepted into this society, I didn't expect there to be an award show. Most of these, like these critics societies, just release the award results online and don't actually have an award show. But, you know, they pulled out all the stops. We had this huge award ceremony in like a spectacular venue. A lot of the people that were there, you know, had been to like, you know, some of the bigger award shows, were saying that our food was better, our presentation was better, which is, you know, maybe they're just saying it, but it was insane because there were some big people there. Guillermo del Toro was there to accept Best Feature for The Shape of Water. Sally Hawkins was there, and she brought the entire crowd to tears. Jessica Chastain got a Trailblazer Award, and her speech was just so great. Gary Oldman, Edgar Wright. There was just so many people that actually showed up, and I was so surprised at how great this event was. And I was presenting, I should say this, you know, as we're trying to be progressive. So I think I talked in the podcast in the past, we have a best female director and best male director. We have some categories like best stunts. I really fought for one of these categories, which is best visual effects / animated performance. Because, you know, I think, you know, the tides are changing. The live action films are becoming more visual effects heavy, and we're getting more stuff like Avatar and, you know, Jungle Book and War for the Planet of the Apes. And that was what won that award, which I presented that in the visual effects. And Andy Serkis was not there to accept, but the award was a combined award awarded to both Andy Serkis and Weta, and the wizards from Weta were there to accept. It was just a fantastic evening all around. It was not broadcast anywhere. I think it was taped and will be put on YouTube. I'm not sure who will watch it, but there's really a spectacular two speeches on there that if it is put on YouTube, I will post on the site at a later date. It was a lot of fun, and I feel so lucky to be part of this organization, and it's one to watch for sure. But let's go from there to the news, and let's talk about some other awards. The 2018 Directors Guild Award nominations have been announced. Brad, what do we know?
Yeah, so the Directors Guild Awards are one of those awards that is a good predecessor and predictor to the Academy Awards coming up here soon. The nominations will be announced sometime later this month. And for the Directors Guild Awards, we finally got to see Greta Gerwig get a major director nomination that she has so rightfully deserved for a while now. For those who don't know, Greta Gerwig is the director of Lady Bird. And when it comes to certain awards, she's been locked out from getting a director nomination. There have been a lot of male nominees this season, despite the fact that there are plenty of female directors who with movies that are awards contenders. So Greta Gerwig was finally given a nomination alongside Guillermo del Toro for Shape of Water, Martin McDonagh for Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, Christopher Nolan for Dunkirk, and Jordan Peele for Get Out. So that's a pretty great lineup. And it's fantastic that Greta Gerwig was included among them. In addition, Jordan Peele actually got two DGA nominees because he was also given a nomination in the Outstanding Directorial Achievement of a First-Time Feature Film Director, which also includes Aaron Sorkin for Molly's Game, Taylor Sheridan for Wind River, William Oldroyd for Lady Macbeth, and Jeremy Jasper for Patty Cakes. So there's a good lineup this year for DGA nominees. If you want to see the full list of Directors Guild Award nominees for the films that were released in 2017, you can check out the full article on Slash Film. There's nominees for feature film documentary, as well as on the television side for dramatic series, comedy series, and made-for-TV movies and miniseries.
Okay, let's move on from the exciting topic of year-end awards to the maybe not so exciting topic of copyrights. But I think this is something important to talk about. There's some meaty stuff here. There's kind of like this. Actually, I'm going to have Ben explain this because he is the one that wrote this article for the site, which is titled "What Does It Mean for Hollywood If Another Copyright Extension Doesn't Pass This Year?" So, Ben, what does it mean?
Okay, so strap in, because copyright law is not the most exciting stuff. But as Peter mentioned, there's some interesting things, interesting little factoids and things to consider here. So I guess a little bit of background. When the Steamboat Willie Mickey Mouse cartoon was about to enter the public domain back in the 1970s, Disney and a bunch of other movie studios and sort of record companies and stuff sort of teamed up to lobby the government to secure a copyright extension that delayed the expiration of Steamboat Willie and a lot of other non-Disney stuff. And then that happened again in the late 1990s.
And it should be noted, if those copyrights had expired, that wouldn't just expire that film, but also the character of Mickey Mouse. So, so theoretically, another company could make a Mickey Mouse cartoon.
Right. I think that's true. I had trouble sort of tracking down the exact specifics, because a lot of this stuff is really nebulous and really difficult to pin down. But I think there's also a trademark law that works sort of parallel with copyright law. So Disney, I think, has a trademark on the character of Mickey Mouse. So even if the copyright fell into public domain, I think people still might not be able to use that character because of the trademark law that's in place. So that's maybe a bad example for this. But anyway, the short version of this very long story is that if the movie studios do not plan to lobby Congress this year to pass another extension, every single book, film, or song that was published in the year 1923 will enter the public domain on January 1st, 2019. So that's sort of an interesting thing. What does that have what does that have to do with Hollywood? My theory is not really that much, because we've seen Hollywood over the past probably decade and maybe a little bit more really lean into the idea of adapting properties that are in public domain simply because they have name recognition for audiences, and people will be like, oh, we recognize that. Let's go see that movie about that character or that person or whatever. But, last year was a pretty much a bloodbath at the movie theater. There were not revenues may be up, but ticket sales are way, way down. Last summer, the summer of 2017, was one of the worst summers, movie-going summers in recent memory. And part of that is because of movies like King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is exactly one of these movies that I'm talking about that is like adapted based on, you know, on an idea that or a character that is in the public domain. So my thought is because Hollywood is so sort of risk averse and very into trends and you know, making sure that they're not the ones who are held responsible, and you know, there are all of these sort of strategies that Hollywood studios have been going through for a long time now. I'm wondering if even if these things do come into the public domain, I don't really see studios like, you know, snapping up a bunch of properties that were originally published in 1923. But you can go, I mean, this article gets way more in depth into all of this stuff. So if you're even remotely interested in this, I would highly recommend checking out this article. We'll link to it in the show notes. But do you guys have any thoughts about this sort of in general?
I mean, I think for the most part, I'm interested more in the aspect of like the Mickey Mouse situation of it not being that film, because I don't think like, you know, another studio is going to take that film and air that film. Do you know what I mean? Like, no one's going to be selling Steamboat Willie and be making money off that. I think I'm more interested in, like, characters becoming uncopyrighted. Like, I know, like, you know, Buck Rogers or Sherlock Holmes. Like, there are ones that have fallen out of copyright that now are being used, you know, by anyone that wants to use those characters. And that, I think, for a company like Disney could be very detrimental because of, you know, I don't, like you said, we don't know how trademark trumps that or not, but if that were to happen, you know, Mickey Mouse, it's this very wholesome character. Right. And with Disney not having full creative control over that character, it could be very strange.
Yeah, and the Steamboat Willie copyright now isn't set to expire until 2024. So theoretically, sometime between now and then, Disney will have to sort of ramp up their lobbying efforts to make sure that that character and property doesn't fall into public domain. But that, I guess, will be the time when we really see what that specific instance looks like. But yeah, in the meantime, I am wondering if like other studios can pull like a Who Framed Roger Rabbit sort of situation and just pull in or like a Wreck-It Ralph or something, you know, a bunch of different characters interacting in the same cinematic world. And even though, you know, they may be more famously known for appearing in a rival studio's movies way back in the day.
Yeah. We'll have to keep an eye on this. We don't know if, you know, it will be extended or not, but as of right now, it doesn't look like it. So anyways, let's move on to Superhero Land. And first with a story that hit yesterday after we recorded the podcast, Marvel has finally announced development on a Black Widow movie. Brad, what do we know?
So a Black Widow movie has been kind of in the works for a while, simply because Kevin Feige and Scarlett Johansson have talked about it here and there, and they've always been asked about it, and they keep saying, you know, it's still in the works, still trying to figure out, we want to do it, blah, 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 but they never got around to doing it. So now we finally have some real movement in the development department, because Marvel Studios has hired writer Jack Schaefer to write the script for the movie. She's previously known for writing a script called The Shower, which ended up on the Blacklist, which is the list of the best unproduced screenplays that have been making the rounds in Hollywood that various agents and managers and whatnot vote on each year. She also wrote a comedy called Nasty Women, which is like a female-centric remake of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels that caught the attention of Anne Hathaway, which is currently in the works as well. So she's definitely an up-and-coming writer, somebody who is, you know, hasn't done a project like this before. But the fact that they've hired a writer is exciting in and of itself, simply because it means we're finally going to get a movie that fans have wanted for years now. But the question now that we're running into is, you know, what kind of movie are we looking at? Because this is a character that we've seen in six different Marvel movies now. We've gotten a lot of the spy stuff on the side. You know, a lot of people have said they would like to see a Black Widow movie where she's teamed with Hawkeye. maybe the going back on the whole thing when they talk about Budapest from the original Avengers, that kind of thing. But it's tough to say how this is going to play out, because with Infinity War coming up, all bets are off as to which superheroes are going to survive. We don't know which superheroes are going to survive Avengers 4. So does this imply that Black Widow will survive both of those movies, or could this easily be a movie that takes place before the events of the Avengers, some kind of origin story? It's tough to say. There are a lot of different comic book stories that could be used for a Black Widow movie. But a lot of them, you know, do involve spy stuff, and we're getting a lot of female driven spy movies already with Atomic Blonde and Red Sparrow. So hopefully Marvel has a good idea of what they're doing with this character, and that the solo movie isn't too little too late and doesn't go to waste and actually give Scarlett Johansson something good to do.
Yeah, I would have to think if Disney and Kevin Feige are moving forward with a Black Widow movie that they have some kind of interesting take on the character. Like, you know, some kind of interesting genre take or something. I don't know. It just feels like that they can't be going for that same thing that Red Sparrow is going for, because, you know, they're going to be late to the market on that. Ben, do you have any thoughts on this?
I'm thinking the same thing. And I'm also wondering, like, I sort of assumed that Scarlett Johansson would be done playing Black Widow after Avengers 4, because she's part of that pretty early lineup of MCU superstars. And we, you know, have always sort of assumed that a lot of them, their contracts would be ending, and they would be sort of making way for the new generation, you know, people like Benedict Cumberbatch and like Paul Rudd and Evangeline Lilly, you know, to sort of step up and fill those places in whatever the future of the MCU looks like. So it's interesting that they're now thinking about making a Black Widow movie, because that means that either she survives the events of Avengers Infinity War and Avengers 4, or they're thinking about a prequel. It's obviously still too early to tell, but just the fact that they're putting the film into development now is sort of fascinating to me.
There is also the possibility of a reboot. You know, we talk about reboots in movies, but reboots were a thing in comics way before, you know, it was like a big thing in movies. And, you know, every year or so, you know, every few years, they will reboot a character. So the events of Infinity War and Avengers 4 could dramatically change the face of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and there is also the possibility that they could cast someone new as Black Widow for whatever reason. You know, the universe has completely changed, and who knows? Those are our best guesses. Let's jump over to Fox now. Gambit, which has been long in development, has lost yet another director. Ben, is this movie ever going to get made?
I really don't know. So Gore Verbinski, who is the latest director to attach himself to 20th Century Fox's Gambit spinoff, has now left the project. So I think he's the third director to leave, following Rupert Wyatt, who directed Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and the Bourne Identity director, Doug Liman. So right now this project is just sort of hanging out in the wind. We don't know what's going on with it. Originally it had a release date of February of 2019. And as recently as this week, a website was reporting that production was supposed to begin on March 19th of this year. But now that Gore Verbinski is gone, I don't think that's going to happen. In addition to this Gambit, or I guess in the wake of this Gambit news, 20th Century Fox released a bunch of new release date changes for their upcoming X-Men spinoff movies. So Gambit has been moved now from its original February 14th, 2019 date back to June 7th of 2019. So that means that it's going to be a summer movie now, if, you know, assuming it ever gets made, assuming they figure out a director and you know, get everything in place for production to actually take place in time. In terms of other Fox, you know, X-Men related movie release date changes, Deadpool 2 is actually moving up 2 weeks. So now, instead of opening on June 1st of this year, it's going to open on May 18th. So that's pretty cool, because it puts it 1 week before Solo, a Star Wars Story, hits theaters. So it'll give Deadpool 2, you know, 1 week at least to shine and you know, have the box office basically all to itself before.
And a couple weeks after Avengers, right?
Yes, I think you're right. I think it's like May 4th or something, or right around there.
Tell me this, like, you know, Fox has not completely been acquired by Disney yet, but you think a company that was being acquired by Disney would not put one of their big films sandwiched between Avengers and Han Solo?
Well, why not though? If Disney's buying Fox, then that money's going to be theirs anyway.
Yeah, but wouldn't you want more money? Like, it seems like let's get the hell away from Han Solo in the Avengers.
I mean, it's summer. They're going to get that money no matter what.
I think probably the answer, Peter, is that the deal hasn't officially gone through yet, and this is still the remnants of the people at Fox, you know, making independent decisions without Disney oversight. Because I think you're right; they would maybe move it to like the end of the summer or even before summer, because the original Deadpool opened in like a February and did like gangbusters numbers because it didn't really have much competition at the time. So I think if Disney had a say, then they would probably give it a little bit more breathing room.
Is there a chance that maybe that they know that maybe Solo's going to get pushed back?
That's interesting.
Yeah, that could be interesting.
Huh. Yeah, because we have not seen a trailer for that yet. So that's a possibility. There's obviously been a lot of tumultuous stuff going on with that film, but that's fascinating. There's one more X-Men related release date shift that I wanted to mention, and that one I think is the most important one, and that is New Mutants, the upcoming sort of horror tinged movie that Josh Boone is directing, has been pushed back from April of this year all the way until February 22nd, 2019. That is a massive leap. You know, often when movies get delayed that much, it signals, you know, problems behind the scenes and all sorts of troubles that we may or may not know about yet. In this case, the Hollywood Reporter's article says that their sources are telling them one reason for that delay is because Fox does not want there to be confusion in some foreign markets where New Mutants and Deadpool 2 would have been in theaters at the same time if New Mutants stuck with its April 2018 release date. I don't really know if I buy that. That sounds sort of like a spin to me. I don't really know if there would be, you know, Deadpool 2 and New Mutants. If you just watch the trailers for those two things, they're wildly different. And I just don't know, you know, what sort of confusion there really would be between those two movies. Because, yes, there are definitely X-Men properties, but like tonally and even visually, they're so different. So I'm not really sure if I buy that excuse, but you know, just something to factor in.
Yeah, we'll have to keep an eye on this, see if Han Solo gets pushed back. That'd be interesting, because there has been some rumors lately about some additional reshoots, but we have not been able to confirm that, so I don't know if that's true or not. But speaking of Star Wars, we're going to go into the spoiler room and talk about Star Wars The Last Jedi yet again. So if you have not seen Star Wars The Last Jedi, thank you for listening, and you know, leave us here. But if you have seen Star Wars The Last Jedi, and I can't imagine you're listening to this and haven't seen that film at this point, but we're going to get into spoilers in just 2 seconds. Let's start out with there's a new video released by the Lucasfilm Story Group revealing some of the secrets of Star Wars The Last Jedi. Brad, you wrote this up for the site. What are some of the more interesting reveals of this video?
Yeah, so this is it's a nearly 30-minute video that the Star Wars show released. So if you want all the details, you'll have to watch it yourself. But some of the finer points that I thought were kind of interesting were featured the crew, and this includes Leland Chee, Pablo Hidalgo, Matt Martin, Rainn Roberts, all members of the Lucasfilm Story Group. Just talking about some of the development stuff and some of the little interesting little details. And one of the recurring things that I liked hearing was how they were talking about the way Rian Johnson approached certain elements that he wanted to introduce into Star Wars, and how careful he was to make sure that he didn't, you know, step on any rules or things that had been established in the Star Wars universe before. One specifically they talked about is Admiral Haldo's famous lightspeed kamikaze move that takes out, you know, the entire First Order fleet of Star Destroyers. And, you know, he specifically asked the story group, like, is this something that's possible? Does this violate any, you know, Star Wars physics that have been established? You know, can it, if a ship this size went to light speed and crashed into these ships, is this, you know, what would happen? Does this make sense? you know, is it plausible? So, you know, you get the idea that Rian Johnson isn't somebody who's just willy-nilly being like, here's an idea, I want to throw it into Star Wars and deal with it, and I don't care about, you know, anything that the fans think or the mythology. He's a fan just like we are, and he was very careful to run these decisions by the Lucasfilm Story Group, ask them how to make them work, and, you know, really wanted to make sure that it was something that fit in to the mythology of Star Wars. So I like that idea of hearing how dedicated he was to the cause of staying true to the core of what Star Wars is and things that have been established before, even though some fans obviously think that he violated a lot of those rules.
As much as I love that moment, Brad, part of me wonders if that, like, is kind of opening a new can of worms in this galaxy. Now that we've established that you could light speed a vehicle into another vehicle, that why aren't there just kamikaze, you know?
Here's the answer to that, for anybody who is curious, is, first of all, the Resistance doesn't have a lot of resources at their availability. Like, the ships that we've seen are all they have. And so they're not going to be doing these kamikaze missions all the time in the same way that, you know, we don't do kamikaze missions with our military, and other armies don't do the same thing, because you're still losing soldiers and you're still, you know, losing vehicles and things like that. And so part of what was discussed with this, the kamikaze thing, was like, the ship has to be a certain size in order to do that much damage. And it did it. If an X-wing went to light speed and did that, it would not have the same effect whatsoever. So you have to think about the logistics of it. And also just the fact that the Resistance doesn't have those resources to keep, you know, crashing ships into Star Destroyers like that, which is part of the reason why Leia is so upset that they lose all those bombers and Resistance soldiers when they tackle that dreadnought at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, and I would recommend people check out this video, check out this article. There's a lot more on, you know, secret cameos. There's a great bit about the Leia hologram. They actually went into the archives and found a different angle of Leia. That actually is Carrie Fisher from, you know, A New Hope, to actually, you know, put in there, which is actually very cool. But there's a lot in there. What?
We also have a cool little gallery of images, because within this video, they played clips from Last Jedi that have not been released officially online, such as the Haldo lightspeed kamikaze and also the face-off between Luke Skywalker and Kylo Ren. So there's some awesome images of Mark Hamill as his force projection version of Luke that we previously did not have at our disposal.
Yeah. And previously on the podcast, we talked about how Star Wars The Force Awakens had a different ending. Rian Johnson, when he got hired for Star Wars The Last Jedi, he asked J.J. to change two things, one of them being, not have BB-8 on Octu, because he wanted BB-8 with Poe. And the other thing, something else that happens at the end of the film, Mark Hamill had alluded to it. We had speculated about it, but we didn't know what this change was until now. Ben, what do we know?
So in a new interview with a Chinese language outlet, Mark Hamill explained the mysterious ending, the original ending to The Force Awakens. So it basically involved the scene in which Rey meets Luke Skywalker for the first time. And his quote is, "When we were doing The Force Awakens, Rian said, 'We might have boulders floating to show your force emanating. So I was led to believe that I still had the force and it was really strong in me. When I read The Last Jedi before The Force Awakens came out, I said, what? And I called J.J. Abrams or Rian to say, are you guys aware of this? Have you seen a cut? Are there floating boulders? And they said, no, we caught that and we worked it all out. So it seems like the original plan was to have Luke just sort of hanging out on Octu with boulders just floating all around him as, you know, a visual signifier that the force was still strong with him. But then once Rian Johnson's script revealed that Luke had cut himself off from the force, they wanted to make sure that that was consistent. So they removed that part of the Force Awakens ending.
Yeah, no, we had speculated that Luke Skywalker actually took the lightsaber and turned it on. I feel like that would have been the better cut deleted scene. But yeah, this makes sense. It is also, I think, very it's a signal of how very little the filmmaker that is directing this current film has to do with the next one, and how little of a plan there is. Do you know what I mean? Because much of The Last Jedi had to do with Luke Skywalker, you know, him shutting himself off from the Force. And if J.J. Abrams didn't imagine that, then it seems like he had almost no say in where they went with The Last Jedi, which I know Rian Johnson has said that they've kind of gave him full reins to do whatever he wanted. Yeah, but let's talk about what he did do, and let's talk about the ending. I know some people had some problems with the ending, and there's also a questionable moment. Rian Johnson is now doing press, and he has explained it for us. Brad, what did he say?
Yeah, so in Luke Skywalker's last stand on Krait, when he faces off with Kylo Ren, obviously we learn that this isn't actually Luke Skywalker. It's a force projection of himself that Luke Skywalker is controlling from Ahch-To. So one of the bigger problems that people have had, aside from the sheer idea of Luke Skywalker using the force in this fashion, is that they don't understand why Kylo Ren doesn't realize that when Luke Skywalker gets out the lightsaber that once belonged to Ben Solo's grandfather, Anakin Skywalker, why he doesn't realize that it's fake, because that lightsaber was broken in half when Rey and Kylo were both using the force to grab it, and there was this blast of energy that knocked Kylo Ren out and allowed Rey to escape afterwards. So Rian Johnson has answered this, and this is something that you can really kind of assume yourself. It's actually exactly what I had assumed the explanation was about this, but some people need these things explained to them, you know, very bluntly and clearly. What Rian Johnson has said, he also talks about why Luke appears younger than the way he appears on Ahch-To. And so Rian Johnson says, Luke's basically tailoring this projection to have maximum effect on Kylo. He knows that Kylo's Achilles heel is his rage, and so that's why he makes himself look younger, the way Kylo would have last seen him in their confrontation at the temple. And that's why he decided to bring Kylo's grandfather's lightsaber down there. The lightsaber that Kylo screamed at Rey, that lightsaber belongs to me. As far as Johnson's concerned, Luke believes that Anakin's lightsaber will have a much more visceral impact on the erstwhile Ben Solo than Luke's own green blade. Johnson also adds, we as an audience see that the truth is we see the lightsaber split in half. Kylo sees a blinding flash of light and is knocked unconscious. Rey takes the lightsaber away before he wakes up. So if you really want to dig into it and get an explanation, you can say that he doesn't 100% know what happened to the lightsaber, which is clear. There's no way for him to know, because as far as he knows, he wakes up, lightsaber's gone. He knows Rey's been in contact with Luke. So, of course, she could easily give it to Luke. Luke shows up, has the lightsaber. He has no idea that it's broken or anything like that. And if you think it's silly that Kylo Ren doesn't remember that, go ahead and knock yourself out and tell me how much you remember leading up to that point. Anybody who's been knocked unconscious knows that you don't exactly remember what happened just before you got knocked out.
Yeah. So, no, I never had a problem with the lightsaber thing, and not that I have a problem with how Luke presents himself, but like, it did seem like a strange decision to me when I was watching the film, because I was like, this isn't how Luke looks, and like, what's going on here? And it's almost as if they wanted to signal to the audience that something was going on, without giving it away, because obviously there's that moment of realization that he's still an Ahch-To. But hearing Rian Johnson's explanation of it, makes a whole lot more sense of why he would project himself in that manner. I want to continue my reputation as being the Last Jedi Debbie Downer. to present my case against the Star Wars Last Jedi ending to you guys and see and hear what you guys think. I think the only thing that bothers me about the Last Jedi ending is that it's kind of like the story that takes place in this fantasy world, that in the last few minutes they introduce this magic ability that we've never seen before, and that's how the hero defeats the bad guy. And I have no problem with the Force having the ability to astral project you to another place. And I like that. I love the fact that if you do it that far of a place, it's going to kill you, because then that makes it not a, you know, overused ability that could, you know, break the world of this story. But I really do feel like they should have set this up a little bit. I feel like the easy way would have been to actually have Luke training Rey at some point, right? To have him teach her the ability to force project herself to another part of the island. And in that teaching somehow explain that you can't go any further. To go further would kill yourself or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, and have it be like very subtly written by Rian Johnson in a way that it doesn't like set it up and make it seem like, oh, I know what's going to happen in the ending. I don't know. I have real problems that they did not, that this is kind of like, you know, the end of a movie, a good guy going into the end of the movie, and he has this gigantic weapon that we've never seen in the whole rest of this franchise, and we just assume that he had it all along.
I think I would have a problem with that if what he did actually resulted in the defeat of the First Order or of Kylo Ren, but it doesn't. All it is is a distraction to allow the Resistance to escape, and B, a spark that signals to other people around the galaxy that Luke Skywalker is still alive. Look at this amazing thing he did. He is the legend we all believed in. We need to keep fighting against the First Order. So sure, if Luke Skywalker force projected himself and was, you know, a crazy lightsaber warrior and was like dueling with Kylo Ren and cutting down AT-6s, you know, by their legs and stuff like that, then yeah, I'd be like, well, that's a little ridiculous.
Well, tell me this. Why doesn't he? Like, I feel like wouldn't... If he had showed up there in person, I'm just presenting an argument here. This isn't what I believe. But if he had showed up there in person on Crait and, you know, destroyed, like, these AT-AT walkers with his, like, force abilities and, you know, killed most of the First Order that's there, wouldn't that have sent a story of Luke Skywalker that's more than, like, he single-handedly fought the First Order, but he let the Resistance escape? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, wouldn't that have sent a bigger message?
I mean, logistically, he can't, because he has no way of getting off the island.
Yes, and I actually knew the answer to that.
Ideologically, too, you know, it makes a bigger statement for him to be a pacifist in that moment than to, you know, give in to rage or whatever and you know, just go nuts and go into berserker mode and slice all these things apart. I think the statement, you know, that's being spread to the galaxy is like, look how amazing Luke is, and he didn't even have to kill anyone I think that's like an important element of the legend of Luke Skywalker.
Oh, for sure. And a lot of people are going to signal to the X-Wing that we see below the water on Octu. It is no longer in use. And I'm not sure if you've noticed this detail, but it's in the art of the Last Jedi. But Luke's hut on Octu actually has salvaged metal from his X-Wing, which means he can no longer use it, like has the door of the X-Wing and stuff for the door, or the wing of his X-Wing for the door of his hut, which is actually a pretty cool detail. Anyways, yeah, no, I accept what you guys are saying here. I still don't like the idea that a screenwriter or filmmaker can bring out a magical ability in the last, you know, 10 minutes of the movie that we didn't know was possible in this universe without some kind of setup. And I feel like it would have been very easy to do, but
I think a setup would have ruined the moment. And I know this is probably one of those cases where Rian Johnson would cop to wanting to preserve the surprise for everyone. If you cornered him and asked him about that, I'm sure that's what he would say, because any sort of, you know, the audience is so sophisticated that any sort of reference to that ability beforehand, you would be spending the entire rest of the movie distracted, wondering if anyone was actually there for the whole time, you know?
I don't know. I feel like there is a clever way of doing that in that it doesn't like seem like a setup for something.
I think that it's already kind of set up in the way that if you buy into the fact that a Jedi can essentially live past death as a spirit, then there's no reason that a Jedi could not project themselves, you know, across...
I do not buy that. I will say that they do say in the movie, Kylo, I think when he sees Rey for the first time, you know, is questioning if she's really there. And he says, oh, you can't really be here. You'd kill yourself or something like that. Some kind of line like that. So that's the only setup there is. But I feel like that's really not enough. I feel like if this was not a Star Wars movie, I feel like us as critics would not give that much leeway in this ending.
I actually think that because it's a Star Wars movie, I'm actually more critical of it, and I'm perfectly fine with it.
You do not sound like it, Brad. You do not sound like it.
That's simply because you are the Debbie Downer of Star Wars: The Last Jedi.
By the way, Star Wars: The Last Jedi was on my top 10 list, which is more than I can say for all of the Slash Film staff. So,
it was on my top 10 too.
It was on mine too.
Yeah. Just saying. Like, it's not that I hate it. I'm saying
wrong facts.
No, I wasn't talking about you guys. I was saying like the whole collective Slash Film staff. I don't hate the movie, guys. I know I'm getting a lot of emails. People are like, why don't you like this movie so much? I just have like these nitpicks, and I gotta voice them to someone, because if I voice them on Twitter, people just accuse me of being like one of those annoying Star Wars fans that are attacking Mark Hamill. You know, I'm not that guy. I'm not the, you know, I have some logistical problems. But anyways, yeah, that does it for today's episode. You can find more of all the stories we mentioned on today's show on SlashFilm.com and linked in the show notes. SlashFilm Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and television, as well as deeper dives into the great features from SlashFilm.com. You can subscribe to this podcast, SlashFilm Daily, on iTunes, Google Play, Overcast, all the popular podcast apps. Please feel free to send us your feedback, questions from the mailbag, or comments to peter@slashfilm.com. Please go rate and review us on iTunes. Spread the word, tell your friends, and we will see you tomorrow.